Imperialism and Introduction, a podcast from Crowd Talks.
Hi, this is a Crowd Talks podcast, and I'm Shane, your presenter from Crowd Talks. As you may know, Crowd Talks does professional presentations for audiences in a number of different areas and topics. The topic of this podcast today is imperialism. And imperialism has always been an important topic of interest to historians. If you wondered how Australia came to be part of the British Empire, or why Europe spread across the globe in a great flurry of activity after the year 1500, this podcast will help you understand those events. It's an introductory talk, and it's aimed at new listeners who really know nothing about the topic. So I'm not going to explore the more complex aspects of it. I'm just going to keep as much as possible to a basic introduction. Now, you may well know that I published an earlier version of this podcast. This is in fact a second version. And if you already listened to the first one, you may have downloaded this one and wondered what was different and why it changed. And that's because I wanted to amend some aspects and cover a bit more detail in a few areas that I missed the first time. So let's jump in. The term imperialism could be best explained as a conceptual idea that attempts to describe a diverse range of past factual circumstances that occurred in history. And given that this talk is going to range across the whole spectrum of human history, there's obviously a bit of generalization in that approach. And that's one of the perennial problems of generalization, is that one size may not fit all in all situations. The origins of the term imperialism come from the Latin term imperium, which was to have power. And the power was usually exercised in the context of an office like consul, praetor. And so how do we get from that word imperium to what is more commonly understood by imperialism? And the hint is in the idea that you exert power. And so imperialism, as it's commonly understood, is the use of power to control or gain control over foreign states. And it sort of runs counter to this other idea, this other principle called self-determination. But that's a much later idea that was proposed in the 19th century, and we won't talk about that at present. I will add that you'll gather from that definition, I've sort of exclusively applied it to state and interstate matters. Imperialism can be targeted towards non-state actors. And what I mean by non-state actors are entities like private corporations, terrorists, and more commonly in cases where the targets were people who practiced a pre-agrarian type of lifestyle. More about that later. So imperialism was the dominant paradigm of foreign relations from the time of the first civilizations up to the mid-20th century. You could probably call it selfishness without restraint in foreign relations. And imperialism also picks up other related concepts. And I've already given you one of those, which is the idea of self-determination. But there's also colonization, which we'll visit in more detail later on. And I would describe imperialism as best understood as an amoral philosophy that encroaches on the relationships between foreign powers. And I choose that word amoral quite carefully. There are no fixed rules of imperialism. There's no handbook or dummy's guide for the imperialist. So when Tutankhamun became pharaoh of Egypt and he met with his advisors for the first time, they didn't say, oh, great pharaoh, here's your handbook on how to be an imperialist. The actual term imperialism, it gets its conceptual understanding much later in history, and it's not actually used until the 19th century. So the Romans or the Egyptians, they didn't walk around and say we're going to perform a little imperialism today. They just opportunistically applied their power to circumstances that the state or the ruler needed from time to time. The only rule seems to be that if you can get away with it, do it with whatever means available to you. So it's a philosophy for the powerful, and it grows out of that ability to wield power. The historian Paul Kennedy, in his History of the United Nations, which is called The Parliament of Man, provides a description of what motivated great power behaviour, which is really relevant to the type of conduct we're exploring in this podcast. And this is the quote. He talks about three reasons, but I'm only going to give you the first one, because the other two aren't really relevant. There were at least three reasons why the great powers behaved as they did. The first was simply their natural egotism. Powerful animals see no reason to be circumscribed by lesser, weaker ones. That's a pretty bleak explanation, but that motivation, that natural egotism, is what drives imperialism, and it captures the core of the behaviour. It's partly for that reason why I adopt the definition of imperialism as a type of amorality, and I'll explain my thinking around that as the podcast develops in a bit more of a minute. But imperialism also has a number of associated tools. The most obvious one is military invasion, and then to be able to hold the territory that you perhaps invaded, you may require other tools like colonization. And colonization is a way to maintain a long-term entrenched presence in a territory. And you can do that either by sweeping out the existing population completely from the territory, or you can implant part of your own population to form a loyal core within it. And there's been numerous examples of this over millennia. Now, we're just going to take a short break and we will be right back. So in practical terms, how does imperialism look? So let's imagine you've got two hypothetical countries who happen to be neighbours. On one side, you have the Republic of Trumpa, and on the other, the Republic of Narnia. And Trumpa has a province called Dixie. Narnia was recently a kingdom, and it's now a republic, after it violently beheaded its kings and queens. And it demands that Trumpa give them Dixie, and Trumpa refuses. An aggressively confident Narnia raises an army, invades the province and occupies it, and declares that it and its inhabitants are now part of the Republic of Narnia. And this is the most simple example of how practical imperialism works. And you can note that no one asked the inhabitants whether they wanted that to happen. And to stay, Narnia might want to consider how it's going to deal with the population long term. Or it just might get rid of it, and it's going to bring in its talking animals, and they'll live in Dixie and be happily ever after. I'm just going to return to this idea of opportunistic use of power. And I've said previously that the Romans and Egyptians just applied their power to circumstances they needed to from time to time. It's this application of power opportunistically that encourages me to characterize imperialism as an amoral practice rather than an immoral one. And the origins of imperialism lie in distant antiquity. Ethical self-awareness is definitely not one of antiquity's high points. So hence why I think you get a better historical understanding of it as amoral behaviour. It's this universality, though, of how societies and cultures drift into this imperial mode of conducting relationships. It's really striking. There's no serious challenge to the idea of imperialism, at least among the power elite of the last five millennia. They just accept it as the give and take of politics, and there's no conceptual moral opposite to oppose it for most of its recorded history. Though in the early podcast, I did start to touch upon this idea of self-determination and how it runs in the opposite direction of imperialism. But that's not that's not proposed as a serious proposition until the 19th century. And it's no coincidence that it occurs at the same time that an academic understanding of imperialism starts to commence. Really, before the 19th century, for the ruling elite of nations, imperialism is just behaviour that's assimilated into the normal day-to-day behaviour of a government or state. The persistence of imperialism over many millennia is certainly borne out by how early it commences. And you can have an example readily furnished by ancient Egypt. Egypt had a near neighbour in its earliest periods, the Kingdom of Kush, also referred to as Nubia. Relations between Egypt and this region were tense since at least from the time of the First Dynasty, and both were culturally very different. By the Egyptian Middle Kingdom, Kush has been fully incorporated into the main Egyptian state. So it's now part of the Egyptian Empire. It's not even independent anymore. The same fate that Dixie had when Narnia just took it over and swept away whoever ruled it. Once the nexus between territory and state control arose in very early antiquity, it's not a great stretch to see that imperialism flows out of the nature of the state's needs to exert power where opportunity or other need might arise. When you start to have static forms of economic occupation like farming, and the state control that grows out of that situation, this is where we start to have the imperialist mindset arise, I think. Unfortunately, in these early periods, we are limited by the lack of surviving sources to get a real sense of what the ancient Egyptians thought. And that's a common issue with these early periods of antiquity. By Roman times, there is, of course, the famous Cicero, the senator and lawyer of the 1st century BC. And he does get close to some type of critical introspection about power, but this is mainly in the context of internal rights and obligations, and he doesn't really care much for foreigners. But it's the period after 1500 when Europe is the rising global power, where it's obviously the best well-sourced. So, for example, when the Spanish go to Mexico, there's a first-hand account of that invasion by a man called Bernal Diaz, and he describes in detail the conquest that occurred in 1519. I will note, though, that he did record that account sometime after the events in 1519. It's not strictly a contemporaneous account. So, despite imperialism being a universal phenomenon throughout history, it would be incorrect to say that there's just one type. You have different variations, so I don't want to leave you with the incorrect impression that there's just one sort of template of imperialism. For example, most empires did focus on using colonization as a tool. But the Dutch Empire was very much a trading-based empire with little direct territorial control compared to the British Empire. And it's one of the reasons why the Dutch never laid down colonies in Australia, even though it could. The Dutch East Indies, which is today's Indonesia, was the Dutch prime colony, and it was right next door to the Australian mainland. But there was nothing to trade there, so they just weren't interested in setting up colonies. And the Boers of South Africa also represent a very different type of imperialism and colonization case that's dissimilar from a lot of the others. Now, at this point, I'm going to take a little detour away from the main narrative and go into a bit more detail around the problem of economic imperialism. And this splits into two situations where, on one hand, a country, a state obtains domination of another by ownership or control of the opposing nation's productive assets. And on the other hand, we have a case where it uses its domination to control a particular trade or industry. So, two quite different factual situations. The first type is every Marxist revolutionary's fantasy. And if you want to reach in the history and find an example of the second type, the Opium Wars in China during the 19th century is probably a good working example of that one, of the second type. Overall, though, this type of imperialism, economic imperialism, is quite complex to identify and analyse. And part of the complexity can be the presence of non-state actors as part of, you know, whatever the scenario is. And non-state actors pop up frequently throughout history. In fact, the conquistadors who took out the Aztec Empire in 1519, that account that was related by Bernal Diaz, those conquistadors who took out the empire were non-state actors. And they had no endorsement of the Spanish crown to do what they did. Cortes, the leader, was actually in mutiny against the royal authority at the time. Consequently, the presence of non-state actors can obscure who is really calling the shots in cases of economic imperialism. And any analysis needs to start looking for a substantial component of state interaction with the events to ground the case. That's the first thing that's required. And secondly, there needs to be evidence that the state has overtaken advantage of that domination or actively supported other competitive elements. And frankly, a lot of the claims in this area can be quite dubious. And if you conflate the purchase of assets in the normal dealing of trade and industry as some type of imperialist adventure, that you're on the wrong track. And that's not to say that corporations who buy assets in, particularly in poor countries, do not become exploitative. They do. But simply pointing to widespread domination of economic assets or private misbehavior is not imperialism. It's certainly a sovereign risk for a country who's overexposed to it. But that's a different issue. And another off-the-track case, which I tended to encounter as a teacher, I used to get this question from students from time to time, is whether forager peoples can be imperialists. And I'm talking about people here who don't practice an agrarian or pastoralist lifestyle. They are hunter-gatherers. And we're talking about people like the Australian Aborigines who are pre-agrarian hunter-gatherers. And people who practice agrarian or pastoralist lifestyles often develop a state apparatus with a military executive and a judiciary. And you see that in ancient Egypt. So how do you apply imperialism to people who didn't possess a state apparatus of a traditional government? Because hunter-gatherer people, they didn't need to have a state apparatus. The nature of their production and their lifestyle made it unnecessary. The first thing I think is that pre-agrarian peoples can be quite reliably excluded from actually being or having the potential to be imperialists. And I think it goes too far to treat them as some type of state entity. They just didn't possess the state apparatus. Their own cultural connections with the notion of territory is usually completely different to, say, an agrarian-based economy or culture. And the notion of a foreign policy was completely alien to them. Yeah, they could certainly be the targets of other state entities, like they were in the case of Australian Aborigines and the British Empire. And I think understanding them through their experience of colonisation is a better framework to grasp their situation. Welcome back. So in the preceding sections of the podcast, we've had a few examples of real-world imperialism and a hypothetical one. We haven't really looked at and gotten into the most significant period of imperial behaviour in global history, And for that, we need to start at roughly around about 1500, more precisely 1492. What happens in 1492? The voyage by Christopher Columbus. And so the arc of history after the Columbus voyage in 1492 was very much driven by the process of European exploration, European invasion, and European colonization in this 500-year period between 1500 and the 20th century. And in this period, Europeans become the foremost practitioners of imperialism. But make no mistake, there were non-European imperialist countries. It's just that their profile in the period becomes much less and more dominated by the European countries. And you have, for instance, the Chinese Empire, which was one non-European case, and it had a long imperial history predating the 1500s by a significant period of time. And the Ottoman Empire also starts this period at its imperial peak. And then in later periods of the 19th century and early 20th century, the Japanese also become practitioners of imperialism. But the Japanese case has some special characteristics which make it different from a lot of the others. Europe starts to explore the world and comes to dominate it. There are a number of consequential effects, which includes, you know, state destabilization, the Atlantic slave trade, and the incredible exchange of knowledge that occurred during the age of exploration. And it brings Europeans to every corner of the globe, and the impact varies, but often the first wave of imperial contact was a very negative experience for the target people. And the historian J.H. Parry, who wrote The Spanish Seaborne Empire, he describes the effect of Spanish contact on the indigenous people of the Caribbean islands, and this quote is from his leading work published in 1966.
In every province of the Indies, the European invasion was followed by a steep decline in the numbers of the native population. In the Greater Antillean Islands, the decline began very shortly after the invasion and was clearly perceptible to Spanish observers within a decade or so of the first settlements. Missionary chroniclers attributed the high death rate to ill treatment and overwork. They hoped that legislation and stricter royal control would arrest the decline. Both missionaries and officials were struck by what they described as the physical weakness of the Tainos. They thought that a stronger race would be better able to bear the labor of cultivation and gold washing, and for this reason advocated the import of African slaves to ease the burden upon the natives.
The extract from Parry makes it quite clear that the modern idea of inclusivity just wasn't a factor in Spanish 16th century thinking. And there's some pretty obvious chauvinism in the extract. No surprise about that, though. It's very much the rule for this period and not the exception. I think the most striking thing about chauvinism, if we're going to talk about it in relation to imperialism in this period of European expansion, is the bias against people who were of a particular type of economic development. And the example of Australia is a prime case. And this arises out of the problem that Europe has with this bias against pre-agrarian peoples. And in European thinking at the time, hunter-gatherers were held to have a lower level of economic development. And so with these pre-agrarian people, European law also had great difficulty accepting them as having any sovereign attributes at all. And so hunter-gatherers had this peculiar experience of not really being accepted into the imperialist paradigm in the first instance. It was basically just pass go and go straight to colonization if you want their land. Now, as a teacher, I used to get a frequent question as to whether imperialism is ever justifiable. And when a potential factual situation occurs with the possibility of this, it's almost always because there's some aspect of self-defense that's attached to the scenario. And if self-defense is not present, there would need to be some other overriding moral principle to really justify it. You know, that old chestnut, weapons of mass destruction. Or in one of the supreme ironies of the age, the incident where the British Empire bullies Brazil over the Atlantic slave trade. The suppression of the Barbary Coast slave states is another example, but I think that's actually one that fits more into the case of self-defense. The Barbary Coast states were active in the early 19th century, and they were just rogue states. Their proximity to Europe and their love of slave trading, it produced this tension, and their raiding as well, onshore raiding. Then becomes a question as to whether it's justifiable to use force against them. And of course, it is justifiable to use force against them because they're predating on shipping and other people's lands, and they're taking slaves. So not all cases of aggression need to be imperialistic. And in the case of the British Empire's behaviour towards the Brazilians, yes, this is imperialistic, but the purpose of eliminating slavery made it justifiable. And the Brazilian case is one of those examples where a better moral principle triumphed over the usual temptations of, you know, power, expediency, and opportunity. So, yes, when the British Empire did bully Brazil over its ongoing slave trade, it wasn't for the normal base gain that empires seek when they usually engage in imperialistic conduct. The real struggle for the historian, though, is to find rulers in the post-1500 era who did desist from the traditional attractions of imperialism, you know, coercion and domination in its foreign policy. And this is what makes the whole thing with the Atlantic slave trade a bit unusual, and with the British Empire's attitude towards it. And all this just leads you to the conclusion that the political habitat before the 20th century, it was just such an unforgiving, selfish environment, not only for nation states, but also for the people that found themselves in the sight of a more powerful enemy. That's not to say that the current geopolitical environment is not adverse, but it is different from what was the case then. The really good question, though, is that why does this state of affairs persist so long? The situation before the 20th century. And the tempting conclusion is that no one really had the power to change anything. Now, in relation to the Atlantic slave trade in the British Empire, this is an interesting case study because probably no one else other than the British Empire could have done it. And the only reason why they could do it for was because they had power. And I think that the thing that you should take from that is that power can have liberating uses. It can have positive uses. It doesn't always have to be about coercion and domination. And the abolition of the Atlantic slave trade is one of these, I would call it, inflection points in history, which is pointing towards perhaps future events with the possibility of a different approach in foreign relations as the end result. And of course, at the time in the 19th century, this is a point where there is better exploration, more self-awareness around the issues of imperialism and self-determination. And self-determination, which arises in this period, is really, really important. And it's the concept that people have the right to form their own political government and their own nation. And that is a really big deal, which will emerge more in the next part of this podcast. First World War is an epic event, and this is where we go to next to consider the fate of imperialism. World War I triggered unprecedented consequences for the world. The sheer brutality of the war left both sides of politics numb, but amongst the political elite, I would suggest that, and this is amongst the people who would run the peace conference at the end of the war in 1919, there was little evidence that there was a genuine commitment to changing the old practices. But that was except from one quarter, and that was the United States of America. It was the exception. And ironically, this was the power least affected by the war. Because of the circumstances of how the United States came to be involved in the war, it ended up with a great deal of political leverage. But that did get progressively less after the ceasefire, the armistice in 1918. But here was a nation that not only had the motivation, but also the power to promote some structural change in foreign relations. It was the United States, largely through the influence of its then current president, who challenged the old basis of conducting foreign policy. And some of these old aspects of foreign policy were things like secret treaties, secret diplomacy, and aggressive war. And they're all hallmarks of the imperialist paradigm. Secret treaties existed to keep the public and the other nations in the dark about your secrets, or to cloak your alliance preparations so your neighbours could not put in place countermeasures. The United States president was of the opinion that the causes of the war lay in the old system of these power structures that had informed pre-war foreign relations. The address that the American president gave to Congress in January 1917 was a very large missile aimed at the notion of imperial power and colonies. A significant aspect of that address covered what we would call the issue of self-determination, though the president didn't precisely use that term. The speech was a serious threat not only to colonialism, but it also undermined the idea of territorial annexation. The speech was a unique development in foreign policy because we have a world leader and a powerful leader who is motivated to promote a moral foreign policy. And so it might actually be worth listening to the actual text of that address. And here it is.
And there is a deeper thing involved than even equality of right among organized nations. No peace can last, or ought to last, which does not recognize and accept the principle that governments derive all their just powers from the consent of the governed, and that no right anywhere exists to hand peoples about from sovereignty to sovereignty as if they were property. I take it for granted, for instance, if I may venture upon a single example, that statesmen everywhere are agreed that there should be a united, independent, and autonomous Poland, and that henceforth inviolable security of life, of worship, and of industrial and social development should be guaranteed to all peoples who have lived hitherto under the power of governments devoted to a faith and purpose hostile to their own.
And when the war had ended by November 1918 and the peacemaking began, it's the power of the United States at the peace conference that's assembled in the following year that allows through its leadership a promotion of idealism and moral decision-making and to force the creation of an international organization that would aim to end aggressive war. And this organization was to become the League of Nations. And so, hence, you could call this the beginning of the collective security era. The promotion of this international organization was considered by the American president to be the best chance from dissuading the world from aggression. And this idea of collective security was aimed at deterring that aggression, which is the primary agent of imperialism. It had its limitations, and one of them was that it was not designed to handle the issue of colonies that remained in the hands of the imperialist powers. Because by this time in world history, a significant amount of the world's population sat under colonial regimes. The way the conference approached this problem with the colonies was that it invented a thing called the mandate system under the review of the League of Nations. The League of Nations oversaw the mandate system, and a mandate gave you the permission to run the place and develop it, but also to prepare it for independence. And that was the purpose of the mandate system. When the United Nations came about in the 1940s, this became the trusteeship system. Sounds good, but there were some big exceptions, big gaps with the mandate and the trusteeship system. Some cases of colonies were excluded from the mandate system, and this included places like Algeria, which it had been legally incorporated into its parent imperialist nation, and it was no longer legally regarded as a colony. And so Algeria, even though it had started out in a colony in the 1830s, France had converted it basically into a province of France properly. And so the League of Nations couldn't touch Algeria. And then there are other examples. One of them, of course, was the Belgian Congo, which had the strange legal status of being the personal possession of the monarch or the King of Belgium. And so it couldn't be touched either. And that's not to mention the various other indigenous peoples like the American Indians, who are at that stage being targeted for full cultural assimilation into the United States. So, yes, there were major limitations as to what the League of Nations could do for the inhabitants of the colonies and the colonies themselves. The whole process of creating the League and formalising the peace treaty with Germany did have present and future ramifications for imperialism. It was still not enough to ruin it, but its foundations were deeply weakened, with self-determination now an entrenched part of international relations. And self-determination would ultimately become the moral device that undermined the colonial regimes. Unfortunately, the League was to fail, and there was to be a Second World War, which broke out in 1939, leading to the epic confrontation with Japan and Nazi Germany, who had by this time both transformed into ruthless and naked imperialists. Pretty good evidence that imperialism was live and well after 1919. With the defeat of Japan and Nazi Germany, a new organization for international peace was proposed, driven strongly by the United States, which we know today to be called the United Nations. It was formed to give this idea of dissuading international aggression another go. The creation of the United Nations makes imperialism officially inappropriate as a state practice through the prohibition on unilateral action in its charter. Note the careful use of that term, inappropriate practice, just in case you attempted to call the undertaker. Any claim that imperialism died at this point would be quite premature, so yes, don't call the undertaker. The messy reality of post-war international politics was that there were many tangled threads that required unravelling. So yes, don't jump on the caravan of celebration yet. The unwinding of these tangled threads caused a number of incidents where the foreign policies of the United States and other countries didn't exactly cover themselves in any glory in the post-1945 period. Vietnam, Iran, the Suez Crisis, these are just a few. And the Cold War creates all manner of complications. There were also some Western countries that were much less enthusiastic at giving up their imperial possessions than others. Any astute critic would point out that the persistence of the colonies after 1945, like it did after 1919, is evidence that a full shift was yet to occur. And you don't really have to look hard to find that lack of shift. The French were highly resistant to losing parts of their empire, and you see quite significant anti-colonial struggles in Vietnam and in Algeria in the post-1945 period. So imperialism may be in the hospital, but there are still life signs. And as I foreshadowed just a little earlier, a bit of this has to do with the Cold War politics that occurs after the United Nations is created. Vietnam is probably the best example of this, and it's also where the United States finds, to its eternal embarrassment, backing the French attempts to reinstate its colonial empire in the 1950s. But it's motivated by this desire to avoid a takeover of Vietnam by a communist anti-colonialist movement at the time, and they were called the Viet Minh. These Cold War political issues encourage a return to some of the worst practices of great power politics. An additional problem for the United States is that a moral basis to fully reject imperialism is not always accepted within part of the US political class. So in effect, the great powers get a free pass whilst the fight against communism endures. Now, of course, the Cold War comes to an end, and for a short period of time, the United Nations has, through the influence of the great powers, no longer been sidelined. It gets a lease of life that it hasn't had in the previous 50 years. There's a much better collective response and cooperation among the great powers for about 5 years after the end of the Cold War. But after that, the echoes of the old imperialism become louder. And it's not clearly dead. And in what is arguably America's worst foreign policy mistake of all time, we see it launch a very dubious invasion of Iraq in 2003. And again, we see it in the ongoing tragedy of the Ukraine's war with Russia. And these echoes can be attributed to an ongoing problem that all powerful nations exhibit. And I'm reminded here to go back to that quote from Paul Kennedy earlier on in the podcast, The Historian, where he wrote that the behaviour of the great powers stems from their natural egotism. And as power entities, they just couldn't see any reason to be restrained by any weaker ones. And this seems to be the ongoing reality of geopolitics. And I tend to attribute this egotism more specifically to a fundamental amorality that lay at the heart of imperialist thinking. But unchecked power is the great enabler. And once a moral basis to challenge imperialism occurs in the 19th and early 20th century, the irony is that it was only through the hyperpower, or the uncheckable power, of the United States, the most powerful nation state in history, that it was able to undo the old political order. But the 2003 Iraq case is a classic example of how the uncheckable power can be seduced by the old ways. It was clear in the earliest days of the Bush administration that part of the administration leadership wanted to return to Iraq to complete unfinished business against Saddam Hussein, and that the 9/11 attack was just a distraction from that real goal of displacing the Iraqi government. As we come to the end of this podcast, we can frame some conclusions. They're not lengthy conclusions, which reflects the basic introductory nature of this podcast. So let's start with some of them. I've framed imperialism as action by a sovereign state to dominate other states or non-state actors. It's a philosophy that is amoral. It arises due to a lack of introspection by the state or state actors, and the aggressor state having sufficient power to undertake those actions. Imperialism has been a practice for millennia. It's been practiced across all cultures, and it's not exclusive to just one culture. Once a certain type of economic development was reached, it becomes a tool of state foreign policy. The effects of imperialism could be a negative experience for target people. It also has different variations, and it's also made use of different political tools like military invasion and colonization. In the modern era, European countries have been the most extensive practitioners of imperialism. Its official end was marked by the commencement of the UN Charter, expressly prohibiting unilateral action by states. Collective security hasn't eliminated aggressive state policy in its entirety. And in addition, collective security was not an idea that could directly promote decolonization. The system of collective security did weaken imperialism. But the complexity of the post-war world did not mark its complete disappearance, and it continues to rear its head where power cannot be checked. That's the end of our podcast on this topic, and we hope you have enjoyed it as much as we had making it. If you have any questions or comments, please email them to us at the following address: crowdtalks, all one word, crowdtalks@proton.me.